And now, it's time for the Talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello and a very good morning. You're very welcome along to another edition of the 9 to noon show. It's Thursday the 11th of December, 9:05. How are you all doing? I hope you're very well. It's great to have you on board. We really do appreciate it. And we've got a wedge 3 hours for you, so we'll keep you up to date with all the very latest happenings at home and further afield. We've got conversations that matter to you on issues that matter to you. And of course, your calls and comments and emails. WhatsApps and texts to 086 60 25000, 086 60 25000. That's WhatsApps and texts. If you're joining us from outside the Republic, 00353 86 60 25000. We want your views too. If you want to give us a call, it's 07491 25000, and email anytime from anywhere, comments@highlandradio.com. And just to encourage the many of you that listen to the overnight replay, feel free to text in as you're listening. We can pick up those comments, right, and carry them over to the next live show. And that same goes for the podcast as well. So there's no excuse not to be part of the biggest show in the Northwest. Right, let's look at the papers. It's a Thursday, so lots of them out. The Tyrconnell Tribune, they focus on a farming story. With Ireland set to lose out by more than $2 billion in new CAP programme, Donegal's share of the funding is expected to fall sharply, putting added pressure on scarce resources. The farm sector in the county predicts they will be left with a deficit of at least $25 million before inflation and input costs are factored into their new payments after 2027. On Thursday of next week, Ireland's farm leaders and their members will join with tens of thousands of others for a big demonstration in Brussels, campaigning to halt the Mercosur deal to import 99,000 tonnes of beef and poultry unless they are in compliance with EU traceability and free from hormone and growth-enhancing medicines. So you know that story, don't you? Many of those animals will be coming from South America, and we've seen because of exposés in the Irish Farmers Journal that they play fast and loose with hormones and antibiotics, etc. On to the Donegal news this morning, and construction waste and cross-border man-in-the-van operations are major contributors to illegal dumping in Donegal. Figures provided to the newspaper reveal 608 illegal dumping complaints were received by Donegal County Council's environment section in 2024. That's a lot, 608. So that's, you know, you're not shy off two a day there. Waste Regulations Officer Matthew Byrne said last year's figure showed a slight ebb on previous years, and while great strides are being taken to tackle illegal dumping, there is a noticeable rise in illegal cross-border activity. Speaking to the Donegal News, Mr. Byrne said people have been liable for fines after booking a man in a van in good faith to remove their household items. We have done so many campaigns to make people aware that if they're getting someone to remove their rubbish, to ask them for their waste collection permit. Does that happen often? Now, you know, you can pass on the information here in absolute confidence, right? We're not here to judge or police. But I wonder, are there lots of people then who are using these types of services in good faith? And lo and behold, maybe, like that dumping we heard about in Dookery yesterday, maybe that's where it ends up, on the back roads, and not just the back roads of our beautiful county. I wonder then how much of the waste that we see is man in the van dumping and how much of it is, you know, individuals dumping. Maybe you have an insight, you can help us understand better. 086 60 25000. The Western Health and Social Care Trust has acknowledged gynecology waiting lists in the trust and regionally are unacceptably high. This is the Derry News. A spokesperson for the trust added, "We sincerely apologise to our patients for the delays and the impact this may have on their care." And that's not going to help much. An apology, I suppose. What do you think about these new policies that are coming into play? And they are likely to come into play. They're proposed at this stage. So it's a new US visa requirement. I think it was only a couple of days ago, was it? I don't know if I was having the conversation on air or off air, but, you know, I've never been to America, and I've always harboured this notion of wanting to go, you know, to have that experience. I know for many of you it's very, very familiar, and it's not about fear or anything like that there. I just have felt that America's just not quite, doesn't feel as an attractive as a place to go as it had been in my past, if that makes sense. And I can't really put my finger on as to why. But this sort of initiative doesn't feel very welcoming at all. I would not be, I have nothing on my social media that I'm that I would be bothered about anyone seeing, but I still don't want to hand it over to say, look, check out my opinions on things. You know, I mean, this is the United States is the land of free speech, you know, the First Amendment. And yet you could be barred from going into America if you were anti-Trump, for an example. I mean, how does that align with the freedom of speech, etc.? Well, authoritarian moves by Donald Trump's administration to ask travellers, including from Ireland, to hand over 5 years of social media history has been branded a massive overreach that would damage relations with the US. Under the new policy announced this week, all tourists, whether they require a visa or not, may have to undergo social media screening to enter the US. The proposal, which is open for public consultation for 60 days, comes as the Trump administration has ramped up security or scrutiny of foreign travellers. Fianna Fáil MAP Barry Andrews branded the plans for social media screenings outrageous, saying even the worst authoritarian states in the world do not have such an official policy. Now, I don't think it's as simple as deleting your social media and presenting your phone and saying, oh, look, you know, they have ways of scraping social media very, very quickly to determine whether you were telling the truth or not. Like, let's just say hypothetically, I'm not having a go at Simon Harris, but, you know, Simon Harris, you know, called Donald Trump a gal. Does that mean like he's not going to be allowed to get in? Or if you're anti-Israel, you know, it's not necessarily, the papers really aren't picking up on this, but a lot of this would be, and it's happened already, where people are refused visas because they've been anti-Israel on their social media. So this has kind of happened already. There has been social media screening, but this would be next level. And I just wonder, would it put you off? Maybe it wouldn't. I don't know. The Irish Times reports that the reason for Ireland's high electricity prices is difficult to establish. The Economic and Social Research Institute has said residential electricity prices in the second half of last year were roughly double what they were in 2018, an Oireachtas Committee on Climate, Environment and Energy heard yesterday. Citing Eurostat data, the ESRI said Irish electricity prices have fallen in the last 2 years from their 23 peak, but the decline has been less than in many other European countries. In addition, prices are likely to rise further with more increases over the next 5 years, Niall Farrell, Associated Research Professor with the ESRI, said yesterday. So the ESRI don't know why the prices are so high. Well, maybe the ESRI, now they know way more than I, might have a look at the profits the companies are making in this country, compare them to European profits. Did they do that? Is it possible that they are making more money than the European counterparts because we are the idiots that just pay? Or is the answer contained on the front of the Irish Daily Mail part of the answers? An average of €1.3 million worth of wind energy has been wasted every day since the start of 2025. €1.3 million worth of wind energy down the drain. And this is these are wind farms that there's been quite a bit of resistance to, you know, about their location, pouring concrete onto bogs and in peatland, the disruption to the local ecosystem, all to waste €1.3 million worth of wind energy. Billions of euro worth of renewable energy has been missed in recent years or unused because producers are instructed by Airgrid to switch off production. The guidance to dispatch down means wind farms must switch off when levels are high than the grid can handle. That means energy that could be made with the available infrastructure is never produced but must still be paid for by the government, right? So we're still paying for this power that's generated, but we're not actually receiving it. This has prompted calls for the state to explore providing free energy or a social tariff to families in energy poverty at certain times of the day to cut down on waste. This is squandered energy that's already being paid for. €414 million in wind energy in unused in the past 10 months. You know, I mean, that's crazy, isn't it? You know, and yet we're paying some of the highest rates. The gap between wholesale and retail in electricity is one of the widest, if not the widest in the world here. and yet this wind, they're switching off the wind farms because the wind energy can't be used. That could be given to people for free. The Irish Farmers Journal, Irish farmers were granted a three-year extension of the nitrates derogation on Tuesday after EU member states unanimously backed Ireland's case. The extension until 2028 will see the Department of Agriculture undertake the onerous process of completing almost 600 detailed appropriate assessments from the European Commission, which the European Commission says are needed to determine whether the derogation is compatible with the Habitats Directive. The outcome has been widely welcomed by both farming organisations and politicians, but concerns remain about the appropriate assessment process and the tightening of nitrates rates from 2026. RTE are looking to cut more fat, it would seem. The Irish Daily Star reports the RTE will outsource production of the lotto coverage to cut costs, its director general told the Oireachtas Media Committee yesterday. Kevin Backhurst was asked by Social Democrat TD Sinead Gibney what services it aims to source from the commercial sector. He replied, radio, sports, news and current affairs will remain in-house. The lotto will be going out because the cost... that costs us a lot of money, and there's a better way to do it. It also enables us to let a few more people leave. We've already talked about Fair City and the Late Late Show, publicly, and we're doing feasibility on these. So the shows aren't going. It just means that rather than hiring and paying staff and doing this internally, that they would go to an external company and get them to do it instead. Bizarre story from Northern Ireland in the Irish Daily Mirror. A postman has been sacked as cops launched a homophobic hate crime probe. Ring doorbell footage from a house in Rosebery Gardens in East Belfast appears to show him kicking over a rainbow garden gnome and a planter containing a pride flag. So he just walked past it and gave it a kick. One of the occupants, who does not wish to be named, said she and her fiancé had returned home to the damage and were astounded when they discovered the identity of the culprit. She added, "We were absolutely stunned when we checked the footage. You never expect to see your own postman looking around to make sure the coast is clear and then deliberately kicking over your property. It wasn't just a gnome and a planter. It felt like a targeted message, and that's what really shook us." So he's been sacked. And an investigation is ongoing as to whether kicking over this bucket with a pride flag in it was a hate crime. And just finally on the Eurovision, Ireland's not in it this year. RTE absolutely delighted about this. They can take a high moral ground, which I'm not questioning, but also not have to fork up for all the people that go over to the Eurovision. Iceland will be the fifth country to boycott Eurovision 2026 in protest at Israel, its national broadcaster confirmed. The Nordic country joins Ireland, Spain, Slovenia and the Netherlands in staying away from the song contest in Vienna. The others walked away last week after European Broadcasting Union members agreed not to hold a vote to suspend Israel over the Gaza war. Iceland's broadcaster, RUV, said voted yes, at the summit along with most counterparts in Europe, including the BBC. But Icelandic media minister, he later said it would be unfortunate to participate alongside Israel. And they're in for a bit of a sticky wicket on that one because they're talking about which countries are going to be in or out at the moment. I have a feeling that that whole competition could turn into a PR disaster and it could be the death knell of it. And I'm not saying publicly here necessarily whether Israel should be in it or not, but it's going to be effectively a lot of people saying protesting against it, then those inside it seeming to be aligned with Israel's actions in Gaza, and it's just going to turn into a very, very, very big, far bigger than it is now, political football, which is not what the Eurovision was ever about. And you can't try and be all fun and games and camp and everything that the Eurovision is great, what makes it great, but then sort of be entrenched in, you know, politics, which it is now as well. It's very problematic. They've set precedents before with the exclusion of Russia, but Israel's okay, and so on and so forth. So it's a messy business. But it will get even more so as that competition approaches. They'll struggle to handle the PR message there. Right, now, the end of term is almost upon us, for Christmas anyway, and we're creeping towards those final nativities, the Christmas concerts, the carol performances and Christmas exams. So the WhatsApp groups are all alight with discussion and talk at the school gates. It's turned to what will we buy the teacher for Christmas, but should we? How do parents and teachers really feel about Christmas gifts for teachers? And if parents are going to send a gift, what do teachers really like to receive? Well, to tease this all out, Jen Hogan, author and journalist with the Irish Times, joins me. Good morning, Jen.
Good morning, Greg.
Lovely to have you on the programme. Right, Jen, what do you think, straight up, should we or should we not be gifting our teachers and what have you at this time of year?
Yeah, it's a hard one. I mean, personally, I've always been part of either the school collection that happens within the WhatsApp group or given individual gifts. But when you sit down and you talk to parents and teachers about this, as I did, you start to realise that maybe it's something that we need to revisit, because it's become commonplace. It's become just a normal practice. And yet it's a huge source of stress and financial pressure for so many people. And that largely comes down to the fact that, you know, some people have multiple children. There's perhaps more than one teacher that they're trying to buy gifts for, even within one child setting. There's SNAs maybe in a class as well that people don't want to leave out. And the list is getting ever longer. Who do we go to? So within kind of the school setting, it might be the teacher and the SNA. And then there's maybe a belief that you have to go around the principal. Maybe there's a deputy principal or a vice principal. There's the lollipop lady and the lollipop man. And it's growing legs. And everybody feels that they should gift at Christmas because it's the done thing. And also there's that fear that in some way it's kind of throwing shade on the teachers or another member of staff if you don't do it. And it's absolutely nothing to do with that, because as a whole, parents are hugely grateful for the work that teachers do. But at the same time, they're under financial pressure and every other type of stress as they're trying to get around everybody and all the financial asks that come at Christmas. And also, the amounts are increasing as well. That's what, you know, we're in the middle of a cost of living crisis. Buying a small gift has become increasingly expensive when you're contributing to class collections. Having spoken to parents, they're asking for sometimes between 5 and 20 euro. It really depends on the class and it depends on the school. And if you're doing that for multiple classes and multiple teachers and individual children might have other important educators in their life, support teachers and maybe bus drivers even to take them to special schools. There's so many different layers to this that it has got out of hand very quickly. There were some parents really worked up about the cost, and there were some teachers equally who were mortified about
We'll get on to the teachers in a sec. But in terms of the parents, right, so you're saying parents feel pressure. Like, say, for instance, you've got a kid in an INRA or a national school. Maybe it depends on which national schools you're in, where you're at. But for me, it was always sort of one teacher in national school, or if you've got a younger one, there could be a group in INRA. Like, is it not up to... Do the parents feel that they have to do this? Is that where the pressure comes from? Or do they feel the teachers deserve it and they're prepared to try and stretch themselves to reward them?
It was a combination of both. There are some parents who feel quite strongly that they want to say thank you at Christmas to the teachers for what they have done during the first term so far. And that's not to say that the others who don't feel that it should be a practice aren't hugely grateful. I suppose it's just kind of a mindset there. But this is very much parent-driven. This is not teacher-driven. There is not an expectation from teachers that they'll receive a present.
That's right.
This
interesting
is driven
then.
By parents.
So give us the feedback you've got. Parents. Give us the feedback, sorry, Jen, you've got from teachers then.
From teachers, I suppose, they say that they're mortified, absolutely mortified with the presents coming in. Some reference the fact that they have seen families that they know are struggling send in a child with a gift just so that they're not the only child who doesn't give a gift. And that's, I suppose, that's where that pressure comes back to both parents and teachers witnessing it too. It's not just feeling pressure, feeling obligated to acknowledge the work that the teacher has done, but feeling they don't want their child to be the only child who's not bringing in a gift. And teachers have seen that from the other side too, where something comes in, like a notebook or pen, and the teacher's going, I have 20 notebooks and pens and my press, and it's not that I'm not grateful. I was accepting, you know, it in the gesture in which it's intended, but I don't need it. And that child's family certainly don't need the expense too, but they don't want their little daughter or son coming in without a gift. So they witnessed that side of things. They talked about, like, nobody needs that many mugs and nobody needs that many candles, and you know that the recycling or the regifting that sometimes goes on. There were some teachers who said they absolutely love receiving a gift, even though that might not be the politically, one person said it might not even be the politically correct thing to say, but I do really like getting a gift. It means a lot to me. Okay. Teachers said that they just love to get a card, but they were very, very conscious and very keen to say there is absolutely no expectation. And that's very clear across the board. There was a teacher with a very interesting perspective who said that she believes there's a competitive nature to this.
Amongst teachers or amongst parents?
amongst teachers and amongst parents. That was the interesting thing. There was a who's the most popular teacher, judging by what comes in, and who's the most popular parent. And one teacher suggested it was even done to try and buy curry favour with teachers. She had witnessed it as both a parent and as a teacher. So she'd seen it from both sides and thought it was very interesting to see how the dynamics play out in some groups.
I suppose the general gist is, I think if I was a teacher, the way I would deal with it is I would send a wee note maybe at the 1st of December home with the children and say, you know, it's been a pleasure teaching your children all year. But we understand Christmas, there's a lot of demands on resources. So please, if you were minded to pass on a gift, please don't, you know, or say what I would really love is a handwritten note from your child. Do you know what I mean? And because they're the singular and they can talk to multiples, and maybe we could break this cycle a little bit. Would that be a nice idea? Did any teachers suggest they do that?
I think that would be really appreciated by some parents. It was actually addressed by one parent who said, look, there's other things can be organised. There's very strict rules around certain things like lunch. They could enforce a strict rule around presents just to try and ease the pressure on parents and families, because it isn't just about opting out and saying, I'm not in a position to afford this. The parents feel this reflects on their child, that there is their child will be incredibly stressed. So they could take the pressure off, perhaps, if that was something that was done across the board and the children sat down maybe and made a card. That was certainly the feeling from parents, that it would be very helpful. But I would say again, there were parents who were very happy to go along with the practice of giving gifts at Christmas and even questioned what were other parents given out about, because it is it's just nice to say thank you, and it's a tenor. But again, it comes back to affordability and everybody's individual situation.
Exactly. And I think it has to
going
feel
around and what
it,
they can afford.
It has to feel like If you can, you would, right? But don't be judged if you can't. Because I'd imagine there are those people, are the same people that will leave an envelope out for the postman and the coalman, because they maybe have the resources to do so, or they think it's important. But then you get people, and we've got many of them up here, as you might understand, Jen, given the stats, who really probably can't afford to, and then they don't want to give something cheap. And it actually does become a bit of a pressure, a bit of a nightmare.
Well, there was one mother, and she spoke that, like, she has three children, and when she totted up what was needed to give to the different collections and the presents, it was €150.
Wow.
That is no small amount of money. And so when people think it's only a fiver or it's only a tenner, that adds up if you have multiple children or if there are multiple teachers. And I suppose because there will often be SMAs within a class, there we go, we'll often have two maybe in a class, and because everybody has such different situations, and you just don't know what people's expenses are outside of, you know, you don't know what's going on in people's lives. You don't know what their expenses are. You don't know what their individual situation is. You don't know what their financial situation is. So what might seem a very manageable amount to one person is a crippling stress for another. It should be an unnecessary stress. It is being driven with the best of intentions, I think, by parents. But maybe we need a little bit of help here from schools to step in, like you suggested there, and maybe that's what's needed, because we are in the middle of a cost of living crisis, and we do have families really struggling, and not always visibly struggling. That's the thing. We really don't know. It comes back to not knowing what's going on behind closed doors. and how people are managing. And if we can do anything to alleviate that stress so that the parents and the children, therefore, aren't, I suppose, becoming overwhelmed by the ask, it would be hugely helpful.
OK, Jen Hogan, thank you so very much indeed. Author and journalist with the Irish Times, and you can read Jen's article on this in the Times. Thanks so much for your time. Right, what are you saying? Let me see. Read Christmas presents for teachers. A caller says, never mind Christmas presents for teachers. How is it fair that so many people in the workforce are not allowed to accept gifts from customers, patients, etc., as they're seen as bribes? I know this is an issue in the Gardaí, because I was speaking to a member of the force, and the very strict, like, a guard can't get a free coffee, right? So if a guard, now, this was the word of one guard, and I hope I'm not in any way misquoting what the rules are. But anyway, this is what I was told, and I believe it to be true, that they, at Christmas time or on their birthday or something, the coffee shop said, no, that's on us. And they said, no, I have to pay for it. I can't be seen to be taking anything free gratis. So that's not, that doesn't make sense, does it? A cup of coffee? They're hardly going to turn their other cheek for a crime, are they? But anyway, that's what I was told. And that, I think, is a little bit silly. No issue, says a listener, giving a little something, but the Parents Association in my school asked for €10 each. I simply said, no, €10 too much, and I donated €2. Take that and multiply it by 29 families. Yeah, I would probably push back on an association organising something like that. There's enough coming out of parents for free education as is. I can understand where the association would be coming from, but I hope they understand that for some, that's putting a great deal of pressure on people. Because A, if it's something you're against, you might look like you've no money, or you're tight, or whatever it might be. Or B, if you don't have the resources, it might look like you're A. Do you know that sort of way? Which is unfair. There's too many demands in this day and age. Why would you acknowledge a teacher's work as a parent? Teachers are extremely well paid and only work part of the year. 5 months holidays or thereabouts, people are off their heads, says a listener. Our primary school's parents' committee collects €5 from each family. You don't have to contribute. And then the committee buys vouchers and gives them to teachers. That way, no child feels left out if they go in without a present for the teacher. But again, teachers, unless you want it, right? So let's pull the curtain back. Unless you want it, send a note home with the parents and teachers and say thank you, or with the kids and say, listen, parents and guardians, thanks for your potential generosity, but the greatest gift you could give me is a handwritten note from your child. So it helps them in terms of their development. It takes the pressure off parents, and it's a nice thing because you've got one person reaching potentially 32 kids. Tell that lady people will spend the money the way they want to, and that it, end of story. And that's exactly what people can do. We're not saying what people should or shouldn't do. We're just having a little bit of a chat. Morning, absolutely not donating or giving a present. They are getting paid to teach our children. They're not our friends. It's sheep following sheep. So obviously people who are against gifting are more motivated to text in. I think it's slightly more balanced than the comments are suggesting. In my time, it was the teachers who held a school party and brought in all the goodies for the kids, and we never gave the teacher anything. Another, I'm an SNA and I've always asked the parents to donate to Mary's Meals or St. Vincent de Paul in the class name, which I think is a lovely thing, especially if you do end up with a drawer full of pens and pencils and pads that you don't want. Hello. This is a two-part story, okay? Here's part one. Hello, I wonder, can you help me? We were at the concert last night and my friend Bridie lost her purse. She had money, cards, license, etc. If you could put it out to the listeners, we were sitting 5 rows in front of the sound system. But wait, here's chapter two. Change of plan, the hotel just rang and it was handed in and we are so, so happy. Thank you. Good news, isn't it? So we were going to announce that, but there was no need. Blair James says, great concert last night, Greg, just at the breakfast. Happy Christmas, Highland Radio. Well, Blair, I'm delighted that you had a good time. Megan says, no, give a gift with good manners and write a note of thanks. That's on YouTube. Who follows up and says a handwritten note is sufficient. I agree, and I think it should be. If if the relationship is as pure as we hope it is, well, then that would be a much greater gift, I think. Hi, Beth and Annie and all the rest of you watching and contributing to the programme on our social media. We're on YouTube. So you can watch us on Highland Radio Ireland on your phone, your tablet, your laptop, but on your Fire Stick or your smart TV. We're on the YouTube app there. You can stick us on the corner of the telly. Right, okay, in the corner of the telly, in the telly in the corner or on the wall. We're going to be back with much more after these. Right, now, yesterday, a report was launched, a research report, on incidents of death and serious harm in 2024. The report examines incidents involving contact with Gardaí where a member of the public has died or been seriously injured. The Deputy Police Ombudsman at FISRU, Office of the Police Ombudsman's, Brian Doherty. Good morning to you. Thank you for joining me.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Right. So perhaps you could run us through some of the information that's been collated relating to last year.
Okay. Well, so to begin with, FISRU, the Office of the Police Ombudsman for Ireland, is an independent civilian policing oversight agency led by the Police Ombudsman, Emily Logan. And primarily our role is to deal with and investigate complaints against the Garda Síochána, maybe members of the public. We investigated about 2,226 last year. But another part of our work, which is covered in the report, are referrals of incidents of death or serious harm, of which there were 37 in 2024. So what happens is, under the law, where there's an incident which an act or omission of a Garda member may have led to the death of or serious harm to a person, it's mandatory for the guards to refer that matter to FISRU for independent investigation.
And Brian, just to be clear, it's catching the cases I'm thinking of. We would have a situation where, say, for instance, a person had an interaction with Gardaí, and then some time later some harm came to them or there was an event. Is that the type of case that we're also talking about?
No, absolutely. Four categories of cases covered in the report: road traffic incidents involving the Gardaí where death or serious harm may have resulted, death or serious harm following a period of Garda custody, so either in Garda custody itself or after someone's been released from Garda custody, or where custody hasn't been a factor, so there hasn't been an arrest or no one's been detained, but there has been some form of Garda contact, which either at the instance of Garda contact, death or serious harm has occurred or shortly thereafter. And finally, the last category that we report on relates to apparent or attempted suicides, so deaths or attempted suicides that may occur in custody or shortly thereafter.
So other than getting this information together, because obviously then, you know, maybe loved ones or the people themselves are very interested in how this is followed through or if it's required to, is held accountable. Is that included in this report, or is this report particularly just collating all the various instances and providing just the raw information?
Well, the purpose of the report, FISRU has a statutory obligation to promote public confidence in the work that we do and also to increase public awareness of what we do. And this really is the first annual report in which we'll describe what is a small element of the work that we do as far as the numbers go. As I said, over 2,000 complaints, 37 referrals. But this is a very important area because we're dealing with the more serious end of the impact upon families, upon people that have been injured. So what the report does is it sets out the nature of the referrals that we've got. It highlights the fact that in a lot of the incidents involved, the guards are dealing with individuals who may be suffering from a mental health episode or in crisis at that point. They're also dealing with individuals that may have used or misused alcohol or used or misused drugs, and just allows for society kind of to reflect on the fact that these are the difficult issues the guards are dealing with that then may ultimately lead to referral to ourselves. And the other piece of key information is the FISRU response. So informing the public that FISRU, as an independent civilian agency with policing powers, has the capacity 24/7, 365 days a year to respond to these critical incidents in a timely fashion, conduct an independent investigation and make a decision as to whether a criminal investigation is warranted or a disciplinary investigation is warranted. And that's all done by our skilled senior investigating officers and investigating officers who are highly trained.
Of the 37 referrals, how did in 2024 then, can you break it down to us in terms of whether, you know, how the investigations process progressed or otherwise?
Of course, yeah. So 40% of the referrals within 2024 would be what we refer to as discontinued. But I just want to stress that doesn't mean that there's been anything cursory about the investigation or examination. What that means is following an independent investigation by fishery investigators and gathering all the available evidence, it's been determined that there isn't a criminal investigation that is warranted or a discipline investigation that's warranted. And then in 60% of the investigations, the decision was taken to continue with a criminal or disciplinary investigation. Now, should we be of the view that the act or omission of the Gardaí may constitute a criminal offence, the fishery would then send a file of evidence to the Director of Public Prosecutions for their independent assessment as to whether criminal charges should be brought. And in the cases subject to the report from yesterday's launch, two files have gone to the DPP. Should we be of the view that there's been a breach of discipline by a Garda member, again, fishery would independently prepare an investigation file with evidence and refer that to the Garda Commissioner for their consideration as to whether internal discipline should take place. And again, that there's two files went in 2024.
That two were, if I'm correct, that two were of eight where criminal investigations were initiated.
Yes, that's correct. So when we initiate a criminal investigation, obviously there's a test that has to be met before a file is sent to the Director of Public Prosecutions, which is whether or not the act or omission and there's evidence that may constitute a criminal offence. And I would say that that would be proportionate now. In relation to the complaints that we receive, as I said, 2,226 last year, in a normal year, about between 70 to 90 files would be sent to the Director of Public Prosecutions.
Are we ensuring that we, I mean, in the past, have some of these investigations been too protracted? You know, maybe it's not necessarily cases under the auspices of FISRU, but we have heard from Gardaí in the past that sometimes if a Garda is under investigation, that it can hang over their heads for years on end and can have really quite devastating impacts, according to some. So is it the mission of your organisation to ensure that investigations are thorough but do not last longer than they need to?
Absolutely. Now, we're always very mindful of the impact that our investigations have on either the Garda members subject to the investigation or in the families in circumstances of what has been death or serious harm. But fishery has a statutory obligation to investigate matters in a timely, efficient, effective way and in accordance with fair procedures. And so some of these investigations, because of their very nature, take some time. However, the mission of fishery is to make sure that the investigations are carried out with momentum, so there's no unnecessary delay.
And just finally, there is a demographic profile that I think is worth discussing of those involved in these investigations, not the Gardaí, but the people themselves.
Yes, so as I said, 21 deceased, 21 injured. Strikingly, there was six people under the age of 25 who were involved in these incidents. And those people under the age of 25, four of which were under 18, were all involved in road traffic incidents involving the Gardaí, which led to a referral in relation to death or serious harm.
Okay. Thank you for your time. I do appreciate it. So that is Brian Doherty there, Deputy Police Ombudsman at FISRU, the Office of the Police Ombudsman there. Last year, 37 statutory referrals of incidents of death or serious injury or serious harm, were reported to An Garda Síochána Síochána, to FISRU's predecessing body. That's GSOC. So you might remember a case has been referred to GSOC. Well, now it's FISRU. 15 of those 37, 15 preliminary examinations gets discontinued following independent assessment. That's somewhat shy there, 50%. 14 disciplinary investigations opened, of which two resulted in recommendations to the Garda Commissioner for disciplinary proceedings. 8 criminal investigations initiated, including 2 which identified an apparent criminal offence, where files were then referred to the Office of the Director of Public Prosecutions. Paul Walsh joins me on the programme now. Paul, thank you so much for your time. How are you keeping?
No worries. Thank you very much, Greg, for having me. And yeah, I really appreciate it. And such short notice too. So thank you very much.
And no, and it's useful because, you know, lots and lots of people now use Revolut. And in my head, I kind of have this notion that it's more secure because how I use my money, right? So I've got my principal current account and then I sort of transfer into Revolut and what have you. But other people now, because they've an IBAN number and all, they use it as their principal their principal account, etc. Right, so everyone's different. So, Paul, your situation, back to September, isn't it?
Yeah, so back in September 11th of this year, I was in a coffee shop just doing my normal thing and grabbing a coffee and noticed my card was declined. Very puzzled because I think I'd just been paid and I was a little bit confused of why there was no money in there. As soon as I went outside the coffee shop, I noticed that my whole account was cleaned. My whole Revolut account was cleaned. So about 10,000 had been transferred out of my account through unauthorized transactions within about 6 minutes. So about 10,000 in total. But ultimately, when I was looking into it in more detail, we could see that not only was the online transactions done to cryptocurrency exchange and online marketplaces, there was also a failed attempt in a restaurant in Alicante. So when I, you know, raised this with Revolut, they jumped on straight away and said, oh yeah, don't worry, we got you, don't worry about this, we'll handle this, you know, it'll be fine. And so I kind of, you know, gave it a few days and I was like, you know what, I feel a little bit, you know, comfortable in the safety that they're, you know, going to investigate this to the full degree and find out and I'll get my refund. But unfortunately that wasn't the case. And within a few days they had come back and denied refund for all transactions made. So
how were you scammed there? Was it in the moment of the tap or what? Or at some point prior to that? Have you been able to get to the bottom of the scammers were able to get such unfettered access to your account?
I've been looking into it. I've had cybersecurity analysts help me look into it also. The transactions mainly were in Spain and the online payments to the marketplace were all in Spain. They then had restaurants. They then attempted a couple of restaurants were all in Spain. So I could at least trace it back to someone in Spain. Now, I hadn't been in Spain since May of that year, and this happened in September. So someone was able to, in Spain, so in another country, add a virtual card that is linked to my account to another phone, an Android phone. I'm an iPhone user, so a completely different phone. Then Revolut said, well, we sent you an OTP to that app and to that phone. I was like, well, hold on, you sent an OTP to an Android user that it was in another country. It wasn't me. So that's where the frustration comes from. They have all these logs, or we sent an OTP, which is a one-time password for anyone that doesn't know, or we sent a we sent an SMS. But if all these OTPs and SMSs were going to another phone in a foreign country while I was in Galway, how did this happen?
Yeah, I always found it worryingly easy to, when I've changed my phone to enact Revolut, you know, it's far more complicated with AIB, which is the other bank that I use with Revolut. It just seemed to be right. Okay, that's it. Right. You know, so where's the word of warning here, Paul? Because we can't really get to the bottom yet as to how they got access to your card in the way they did. But they clearly did. And they were able to take the money, which was very hard earned and was being accrued with a view to you know, buying your own home. What's the word of warning here? It's to make sure, is it what banks, what rules they have in place to deal with a you know, no blame scam like this?
Absolutely. So what's an important thing to realize when you're opening a bank account or setting up a bank account, and trust me, I was very tech first and I was very all for Revolut, But if you read their terms and conditions, in their refund and policy, it says the refund policy is up to Revolut's discretion. If you look at the refund policy for fraud in the likes of Bank of Ireland or AIB, it'll state, right, we'll cover up to 80,000 in damages or 40,000 in damages, whatever it is. Different banks have different causes and clauses, rather. So it's interesting that Revolut, when you look at their fine print, they don't seem to have that. So you're not really leaving your money in a bank. You're leaving your money in a tech company that is semi sort of regulated and not really. They're still pushing hard to get regulated in the Irish market for mortgages and loans, but they're still having a little bit of problems there because of security concerns like this. So my main thing for anyone, well, because by the way, as soon as I posted this on LinkedIn, I had other business owners. So I'm a business owner. I own a tech business called Adhere Digital in Galway. I know cybersecurity. We build it in all our websites and our apps and everything we do. So, I'm very tech conscious and I have a lot of security in place. But it feels like Revolut aren't essentially a bank. And when the first thing and the most important thing when it comes to people opening a bank is the security of the money. So they can have all fancy features and automations and quick transactions, but that's all meaningless when your money is not
And
secure
there's
and your
no,
money will not be,
it's
and
bad
there's no
enough that
comeback.
it's not secure. It's the fact that they don't then take responsibility for its loss. All right, Paul, listen, I must adapt because it's the 10 o'clock news here.
Brilliant.
But thank you very much for that. A word of warning there. And people just need to be really careful with the money. I mean, to gather up €10,000, you often have to work and earn 20,000. It's like that. Okay. Listen, Paul, thanks for
Thanks,
that. Look
Greg.
after yourself. Take care.